Now let me turn to the topic of this discussion, and that is the history and evolution of taxation in Canada. I will not get too involved in the history preceding the year 1867, but suffice it to say that there is ample evidence to show that Britain was concerned that British North America, that is Canada, would fall into the hands of the Americans or some other foreign power, and therefore decided to cause or force the uniting of Upper and Lower Canada with a view to bringing the entire country together eventually. The evidence further discloses that the people did not want this union, particularly Nova Scotians who voted not to join in this confederation. However, despite all opposition, Britain finally passed and enacted the British North America Act and established a dictatorship under a dictator known as the Governor General of Canada, who took advice from the Dominion Parliament. Therefore, it should be understood that Canada has never had a constitution. What we had was an act of the Imperial Parliament of Great Britain, and what we have now is the same document referred to as the Constitution Act of 1982. The BNA Act, currently the Constitution Act 1867 to 1982, allocated the powers of the two levels of government referred to as the legislatures, or provinces, and the Parliament, the federal government. These powers were defined and outlined in two separate sections of the BNA Act. First, there is Section 91, wherein the powers of the Parliament, or the federal government, were outlined. Then there is Section 92, wherein the powers of the legislatures, or provinces, are outlined. It is a recorded fact that Section 92 was written first, followed by Section 91, which in fact could have been left out because it is residual in nature. In other words, the provincial powers were listed first in Section 92, and the federal government, or parliament, got the remainder. In the case Nova Scotia Attorney General versus Canada Attorney General, 1951, the Supreme Court of Canada, on October the 3rd, said this: "The Parliament of Canada and each provincial legislature is a sovereign body within its sphere, possessed of exclusive jurisdiction to legislate with regard to the subject matters assigned to it under Section 91 or Section 92, as the case may be. Neither is capable, therefore, of delegating to the other the powers with which it has been invested, nor of receiving from the other the powers with which the other has been vested." The court went on to say this: "The Parliament of Canada and the legislatures of the several provinces are sovereign within their sphere, defined by the British North America Act, but none of them has the unlimited capacity of an individual. They can exercise only the legislative powers respectively given to them by Sections 91 and 92 of the Act, and these powers must be found in either of these sections." The court went on to say, "The Constitution of Canada does not belong either to Parliament or to the legislatures. It belongs to the country, and it is there that the citizens of the country will find the protection of the rights to which they are entitled. It is part of that protection that Parliament can legislate only on the subject matters referred to it by Section 91, and that each province can legislate exclusively on the subject matters referred to it by Section 92. Now, this is the Supreme Court of Canada ruling of 1951. And what this means is that if either level of government has any power, it is granted them by either Sections 91 or 92 of the BNA Act, or what is referred to as the Constitution Act of today. It also means that if the provinces have a power such as direct taxation, then they cannot give this power to the federal government, as they have in every province in Canada except Quebec, which collects its own income tax. Thus, this means that income tax, even provincial tax, in all provinces except Quebec is illegal because of the tax collection agreements between the provinces and the federal government. Legal means written someplace. Unlawful means it does not have lawful authority. So the income tax of Canada does not have lawful authority, not sanctioned, therefore, by the so-called Constitution. The last paragraph means that we should be able to find protection in our so-called Constitution, but I'm afraid that we cannot. The courts are all currently operating under admiralty or maritime jurisdiction. meaning that when we enter the court, we are in a court-martial type of proceeding where we have no rights and there is no constitution. This situation has been accomplished by the introduction of the Uniform Commercial Code, UCC, whose equivalent in Canada is the Bills of Exchange Act. The UCC is an international act which applies to the United States and many other countries. The Bills of Exchange Act in Canada is the equivalent, and it represents Roman law and can be traced back to Babylon. Therefore, we are under Roman law and the courts are operating under admiralty jurisdiction, with the actual supreme law of the land being the Bills of Exchange Act, and suspension of the Constitution has therefore been accomplished. At this point, it might be wise to define direct taxation before we move on in our discussion. Direct taxation was addressed by the court in the Bank of Toronto versus Lamb case of 1887, when the court said this: "This decision of the Judicial Committee is the most important pronouncement of a court on the meaning of the words just quoted. It has, in effect, incorporated into the law the following words of the English economist John Stuart Mill as to the distinction between direct and indirect taxes." His statement was this: "Taxes are either direct or indirect. A direct tax is one which is demanded from the very person who it is intended or desired should pay it. Indirect taxes are those which are demanded from one person in the expectation and intention that he shall indemnify himself at the expense of another. Such are the excise or customs. Therefore, income tax and arguably the GST are both direct taxes. GST replaced the former excise tax, commonly known as the manufacturer's sales tax." So let's see what the B&A Act, which I will hereinafter refer to as the Constitution Act, says about direct taxation. First, let's look at the provincial powers in Section 92 of the Constitution Act and see what that section has to say regarding taxation. Section 92 of the Act gives the exclusive power to direct taxation to the provincial legislatures. Subsection 2 thereof reads: "Direct taxation within the province in order to the raising of a revenue for provincial purposes." Section 91 of the Act gives the remainder of the taxation powers to the federal government. Subsection 3 thereof reads: "The raising of money by any mode or system of taxation." These statements are proven by the preamble to Section 91, which states in part, "It shall be lawful for the Queen, and with the advice and consent of the Senate and House of Commons, to make laws for the peace, order, and good government of Canada in relation to all matters not coming within the classes of subjects by this Act assigned exclusively to the legislatures of the provinces," unquote. As is obvious to anyone, even a bureaucrat, this means that since direct taxation is the exclusive power of the provinces, the federal government has no power to legislate in relation to it, that is, income tax and GST, unless one has a problem comprehending what the word exclusively means. However, in the event that one is a politician, the framers of the Act made this statement a second time to clarify. Subsection 91 brackets 29 states as follows: "Such classes of subjects as are expressly accepted in the enumeration of the classes of subjects by this Act assigned exclusively to the legislatures of the provinces." In other words, if a power is not included in the provincial powers listed in Section 92, then it becomes a federal power. This was elaborated on in the Bank of Toronto versus Lamb case of 1887, when the court said, "Their lordships have to construe the express words of an Act of Parliament which makes an elaborate distribution of the whole field of legislative authority between two legislative bodies." In this case, of course, they would be referring to the federal and provincial governments. "And at the same time provides for the federated provinces a carefully balanced constitution, under which no one of the parts can pass laws for itself except under the control of the whole acting through the Governor General. And the question they have to answer is whether the one body or the other has power to make a given law. If they find that on the due construction of the act, a legislative power falls within Section 92, it would be quite wrong of them to deny its existence because of some possibility it may be abused, or may limit the range which otherwise would be open to the Dominion Parliament, unquote. Now, further, in the event that one totally lacks comprehension, such as possibly is the case with lawyers and judges these days, based on my personal experience anyway, the framers of the Act stated it one more time in the post-amble to Section 91, Federal Powers. Using different wording, it states this: "And any matter coming within any of the classes of subjects enumerated in this section shall not be deemed to come within the classes of matters of a local or private nature comprised in the enumeration of the classes of subjects by this Act assigned exclusively to the legislatures of the provinces." So it's very clear, three times in Section 91, the framers of that Act tried to get the message through to all of us that if any power was assigned to the provinces under Section 92, they were both exclusive and not to be considered or encroached upon by the federal government and not to be included in Section 91. Their powers, in other words. If this were not enough, I quote from a speech by Lord Carnarvon, one of the framers of the British North America Act, currently the Constitution Act. "During its introduction in the British House of Lords on February the 19th, 1867, Lord Carnarvon said this: The several provinces, which are now free to raise a revenue as they may think fit, surrender to the central Parliament all powers under this head except that of direct taxation." He not only said that, he said it twice. Later on in the same speech, he says, "As I have said, it is proposed that the provinces shall surrender to the central Parliament all powers of raising revenue except by direct taxation. Therefore, the power of direct taxation has never been surrendered by the provinces to the federal government." To suggest that these words could have a different meaning today than in 1867 is not only deception, it is bordering on insanity. Yet that is exactly what we are being told, and we are expected to accept from our bureaucrats and politicians and our judges. To continue, on July the 26th, 1894, the British House of Lords was debating a finance bill, number 163. During the second reading, the Earl of Faversham stated, "In the Imperial Act, by which they enable the provinces of North America to federate into one dominion in 1867, the Dominion government by the Imperial Act was expressly forbidden levying any direct taxes, and that prerogative of taxation was expressly reserved to the provincial governments." Then in a letter from Sir Charles Tupper, the High Commissioner for Canada to the Colonial Office, dated June the 30th, 1894, and received on July the 2nd, 1894, it states, "So far as Canada is concerned, the case is even stronger than in the other colonies as, under the Confederation Act, passed by the Imperial Parliament in 1867, the power of imposing taxation of this description, that is, estate duties, a direct tax, was exclusively assigned to the local governments and legislatures of the provinces of the Dominion, for the purpose of enabling them to provide the revenue required to carry on the administration of local affairs." At this time, I should say that it makes perfect sense, if one thinks about it, that taxes raised by a provincial government are spent within the province and not spent internationally. So it's okay, theoretically, to tax the citizens of a province if the provincial government does it. Other than that, the citizens of Canada should never be asked to give money to a federal government because it's spent internationally. And that is to come from the natural resources of the country and businesses. During the House of Commons debate on March the 18th, 1952, Mr. Drew states as follows: "I said that there were different methods, but the method that I prefer, and I have indicated for a long time, is for the Dominion government to get out of the fields that they invaded and to let the provinces have the tax resources that will permit them to raise the taxes for the things they are called upon to do. This dominion government today is a trespasser in the field of provincial taxes. They have not carried out their promise to vacate the tax fields they entered during the war, and they are doing nothing to make it possible for new arrangements to be made on a satisfactory basis. Later in the same debate, Mr. Drew stated, "In this whole problem, it seems to me that the time has come to recognize that the inability of the provinces to meet the need for increased payments for education is simply an incident of the continued and deliberate evasion by the Dominion government of its solemn obligation to vacate those tax fields it entered during the last war, and to find some satisfactory basis of taxation which will give to the provincial governments not only financial capacity to meet their requirement, but the real responsibility for those things which are exclusively within their field." Then in the Lord Nelson Hotel case of 1950, the Supreme Court of Canada confirmed the decision of the Supreme Court of Nova Scotia and stated that Parliament could not delegate its powers to the provincial legislatures, nor could the provincial legislatures delegate its powers to Parliament. Therefore, the tax rental collection agreements that exist between the provinces, except Quebec, who got it right, and the federal government are all ultra vires, that is, not within the powers of the Constitution Act and the powers assigned thereunder to the federal government.